Welcome to a special edition of the Marketplace Roundtable podcast featuring Jay Mintzmyer of Value Investor's Edge. Jay first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2011, building up a large following through his work covering shipping stocks, probably about as comprehensively as they're covered anywhere online or in print. Since 2015, Jay has run the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. The service offers intensive coverage of deep value opportunities in the shipping, energy, MLP, and industrial sectors. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. And now your host, Jay Mintzmyer.
Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon if you're joining us from Europe. We're hosting another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live. Today, we are recording on the 13th of November, 2020, about 11 a.m. Eastern. We are hosting TK LNG Partners, specifically their CEO, Mark Kramer, and their CFO, Scott Gayton, to discuss the LNG markets overall, but more specifically, TGP's positioning with their almost $10 billion backlog and the stuff they see in the markets, where they're focusing their capital allocation, how they're dealing with the constraints and challenges of COVID-19, and any other stuff that we can learn from the firm. Disclosures before we begin, nothing on this call constitutes official company guidance or investment recommendations of any form. I have no current position in TGP, but keep in mind this is being recorded on the 13th of November. So if you listen to a recording at a later date, look for the latest disclosures. Mark and Scott, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much, Jay. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So, you know, let's first talk about the LNG markets writ large. I know TGP is basically 100% covered for the next year or so, and over 90% covered even further into 22. But let's talk a little bit about the big picture of LNG markets. Where are we at with the balances? And then let's talk about kind of part two of that question. What can TGP do to continue to firm up those balances as we look out to maybe 22, 23, and so on?
Sure. Well, in a nutshell, we've had a surprisingly good Q4 that we're in now as a result of, I think we were expecting a little less during COVID. So the markets are very strong. They're over $100,000 per day on ships. And that's fixing at the end of December and now starting into January. We're even starting to see folks that are seeing 2021 spot rates in the well over $100,000. So the market is now good. There's a number of reasons for that. The arbitrage is obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, but there's a good arbitrage for selling LNG, not just to Europe, but also to Asia. So it's around, buy it around $3 in the United States and sell it for around $5 in Europe, or around $7 in Asia. So there is an arbitrage there, and it allows for a fair amount of shipping cost, which is what we are concerned about. We're not too exposed to that. In fact, as you say, Jay, we're not at all. We're 100% fixed now. We just recently fixed through February, and then we take exposure again in the market. Next year, we're about 96% fixed. And the hallmark of TKLNG is we have these fixtures. We have fixed rate, fixed period fixtures is really our hallmark. So looking into next year, we do think it'll soften, not necessarily because the cargo won't be there. Hopefully we have a widespread vaccine and things are recovering, but we think there are probably too many ships for the next couple of years. So the end of, 2021, 22, maybe even 23, we think are a little bit more lean for shipping overall. You'll always have your seasonal ups and downs, but on the whole, we think it's going to be a little bit soft. That's why we're content to be fixed. If we talk about our backlog, I'm sure, but or more about the market. But that's a background check.
Yeah, of course. One of the things that differentiates TGP from some of the other LNG plays is that you are almost, not quite 100%, but almost 100% fixed for 21 and a similar 90% type ratio for 22 and beyond. So I think it, you know, in some ways it's worked against you because, you know, when the broad market falls, when shipping is unpopular, energy is unpopular, your stock kind of falls alongside. But when there's like euphoria about near-term spot rates, you don't benefit from that. So it's been challenging, but that is, of course, the upside, or the, I guess, high point of TGP is that everything's fixed. Let's talk about the LPG side of the business, because that's a little bit more variable, right? There's a little bit more charter roll exposure and some upside there. So any updates from the LPG, like the Exmar pool on those charter rolls, and any sort of updates on those multi-gas ships that are non-core?
Sure. On the Exmar side, well, I should say the LPG side, if LNG rates are around $100,000 a day or over, VLGCs, very large gas carriers, LPG carriers, are around 50. And the market that we're in, which is medium size, it's not as volatile as the very large size, but it's in the 20s. And again, it's held out pretty well, certainly better than oil tankers or bulkers or container ships, other types of sectors this year. We've been pleasantly content with how the rates have held out on LPG. We're earning, as they say, on the Exmar side, which is a joint venture. We have 50% with Exmar, with the medium size. We're earning in the $20,000 per day and doing a fair amount of renewals on that. For that sector, we're relatively fixed out. For that sector, I forget the exact percentages. I'll get them during this call as I look through my notes. Maybe Scott has them, but we're relatively fixed out and feeling good about the Exmar side. The other side of our business is non-core. We, as some investors know, repossessed a petrochemical fleet, 7 small ships. The total fleet is worth a little over $100 million, about half the amount of an LNG carrier. And the rates have not firmed like the LPG side or the LNG side. And there we're still earning around $10,000 a day or so. As I said, we don't have a lot invested. We don't have a great outlook on it, and it is non-core. So although we're large enough not to have to be too excited about selling the ships until there's a right price, when there is a right price, and I don't expect that this year, maybe not even next year, hopefully at the end of next year, we'll look to sell the ethylene fleet.
Yeah, thanks for the update there. We were hoping, I think, that the mid-size LPG rates would be a little bit stronger, that they would, you know, sort of try to meet the higher VLGC rates. We haven't seen quite as strong of returns there, but definitely an improvement in the broad market as opposed to maybe like 2017, 2018.
Can I just make one comment on what you just said about VLGCs? You're right. There is an unnatural arbitrage between what the MGCs are earning and the VLs. So I think something's got to happen. Either the VLs got to come down in rate, or more likely, MGCs lag, and hopefully the MGCs will go up to close that arbitrage between the two sizes. We are over 63% fixed next year. So this comes to the sensitivity that I think we can expect next year will hopefully be minimal, and that's where we're at.
Let's talk a little bit about capital allocation and your leverage targets. You've had this sort of target range of 4.5 to 5.5 for about 2 years now. Is there any shift to that target leverage range? Is that still valid, or do we need to start thinking about something more like 4 to 5 or 4 to 4.5?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. So Jay, on our leverage targets, you're right. We have, for the last couple of years now, been pointing to a net debt to, or an EBITDA to debt leverage target of 4.5 to 5 times. And we haven't made any changes to it. We are still grinding our way towards it, making good progress. We're delevering by, I think this quarter alone, it was about $100 million. And we do see around $300 million on a total consolidated basis. So including all of our joint ventures, which is how we measure our leverage targets. And we are making good progress towards that. I do think that we're going to be within the upper end of that range sometime next year. And you know, and then we'll continue to make our way through that leverage target just simply through the regular amortization that we have that goes on you know, every day and every year. And then, have there been any changes to it? There's been no changes to it. It's something that we do evaluate probably every year, and we're trying to make sure that we're being you know, thoughtful and being consistent the way that we apply it. We have seen and have heard from some, I would say, more U.S. kind of pipeline-based investors of, is 4.5 to 5.5 the right range? Should that be lowered? Are you still carrying too much leverage at that level? And I think that after we explain that, you know, this is a very different business, we do have zero commodity exposure. And I think a lot of the on-land pipelines have kind of shown that they do have a little bit of pipeline or a little commodity exposure. Our assets are movable and our contract lengths are a lot longer. And so if we look right now, we're over 10 years in contract length. With the backlog that we have. And so because of that, we do think that we can carry higher leverage than your average other MLP, which are really working towards those lower levels. So no, right now we're feeling pretty good about our ability to meet the goals, and we haven't moved those goalposts at all, despite the volatility that we have seen in the broader energy markets, because our business, as we talked about yesterday, has actually been very resilient. We expect to meet our 2020 guidance that we put out almost to the day last year. So you can imagine the craziness that's ensued since that time. And here we are just quietly going about our business and expecting to meet guidance that we put out a year ago. So because of that stability, I think we feel pretty good about the leverage range that we've got.
Yeah, certainly makes sense. And of course, we would hope you would hit your targets in terms of EBITDA and whatnot, considering the high percentage of fixtures, right? I mean, it would be surprising and unfortunate if we didn't. Is there any sort of, because since you mentioned guidance for 2020 and hitting that guidance, of course, when should we expect to see any sort of formalized guidance for maybe like 21 and 22? I mean, you have such a high percentage of fixtures that you can give a very reasonable range. I mean, investors with, you know, savvy models can kind of do this at home, but it helps to see it in sort of a presentation. Would that be something we could potentially expect to see by next quarter's results?
Yeah, we did mention on our call yesterday, and I'm happy to do so again, that we do expect 2021 to be in line with the 2020 numbers that we're expecting to come out at. And we do provide pretty decent guidance for what Q4 is expected to be, which is slightly higher than Q3. So, you know, it's not hard for people to figure out where we should come out for 2020, which is within the low end of the range that we did put out. As for 2021 guidance, we're not going to be putting out anything formal. Right now, we're feeling comfortable just to give some directional guidance. And some of the background there is that when we actually started providing guidance, I guess it was in 2018 for the fiscal 2019 year, we were in the middle of a $3.5 billion growth program. And a lot of that was delivering. And I think one year we had six ships delivering, and it was very difficult for the analysts and investors to figure out and determine what our future earnings and cash flow profile is going to look like. For example, we went from $88 million of net income in 2018 to nearly $170 million in 2019. And trying to price that in was very, very difficult. We ended up with estimates that were wildly all over the place, and people weren't able to nail that down. So we said, look, let's give the guidance and let people know where we think we're going to be coming out, and let the analyst community tighten their models up so that we're in line. And I think what we've seen over the last couple of years is the analysts have really come out and really done their work. And right now we're in a pretty tight band. I think this quarter we were 59 cents. And I think Bloomberg had us at 60, and FactSet had us at 58 cents. So within a penny either direction. So the analysts have really stepped up and done their job. So because of that, I don't think we're going to look at putting out 2021 guidance other than just to compare back to 2020, like I said.
Yeah, Scott, understandable that you don't want to formalize it too much, but of course, with the 96% fixtures and whatnot, you can sort of see what's going to happen there. Looking at your recent capital raise back in August, you did a small knock bond. I guess, I mean, small and depends on, I mean, 112 million is not small, but, you know, smaller knock bond issuance at a very attractive rate, 5.74% fixed, and for basically unsecured debt, right? So how do we think about that in terms of your liquidity? Your liquidity is very high, but at the same time, you've kind of paused on, you know, share repurchases. You've been very focused on, you know, just delevering. The delevering kind of naturally happens, right? It doesn't need to be, you know, there's no like prepayments or anything like that. You gave a very clear slide in your earnings that showed all your upcoming debt maturities, none of which seem too challenging for you. So how can we think about applying that capital? I mean, 5.74% unsecured, very attractive interest rate. Your shares are trading at a huge implied, whether you use price to earnings, whether you use DCF, a distributable cash flow. I know you've started to move away from that. Whether you use free cash flow, whatever it might be, the yield on your shares is significantly higher, 4 to 5 times higher than the yield you're getting on these unsecured bonds. So how can we think about that?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It was I think we almost bottom ticked the treasury markets when I was looking at it in preparation for yesterday. You know, we not only got a very low spread, but also just extremely low base rates. And so we're very happy with where that priced. And that does provide us with a lot of opportunity to add some real value, as you said. You know, with the common trading in the 8.5 to 9 range and the preferreds trading probably around the same level. It does give us that ability to deploy some of that capital and, you know, not only add equity value, but also to add free cash flow, just due to the arbitrage between the cost of the various securities. And I think as we look out, and we have done a bunch of stock buybacks in the past, there's some expectation for dividends in 2021 and where that's going to go. And then there's just that boogeyman that's always around the corner of that future equity and bond market volatility. And I think that was part of the reason that we went out and raised the knock bond, was to give ourselves that firepower that when the world fell apart in February and March of this year, I don't think that we had that confidence. We didn't have that sort of cash in the bank ready to put out and repurchase securities, whether they be our bonds fell out of bed. They were they got hit pretty hard in Norway. If we had had this money sitting in the bank, I think we would have been more aggressive buying back those bonds. I think at one point they were 13 or 15% yields. Preferreds, they got down to 12, 13 bucks. That would have been a great buy. And then the common obviously went down as low as 7. So it would have been great if we had had the liquidity that we do today and the confidence in our business and that liquidity position to really step in. So I think what you're going to see is that we're going to be patient. We've seen the markets recently hitting all-time highs, and I think, you know, stepping in at these levels, yes, it does make sense, but it makes even more sense to step in should our securities end up in those distressed positions due to some serious market dislocation. So I think we'll be patient, but we understand the math. It's not costing us a lot because we're able to pay down revolvers, and so the net impact is very small in our overall business to have this extra cash and liquidity sitting around. And you know, we're looking forward to, I hate to say it, but we're looking forward to some dislocations when we can really add some value.
Yeah, Scott, it's good that you have that higher liquidity balance. Of course, investors who are, you know, longer term holders of TGP are, you know, are looking at the shares, and of course they're down, you know, 25-30% year to date. And so, yeah, the market itself, the broad market, is at, as you mentioned, record highs, but that, you know, that doesn't really translate to, you know, shipping valuations or energy valuations. And of course, TGP is kind of a bit of both, right? I mean, you're really an energy transport company, so you kind of, you know, are split between these two sectors that have had such a terrible year. So, you know, it would be great if you were able to repurchase a lot if the shares dipped again, the units dipped again. But at the same time, they are significantly cheaper than they were, you know, at the start of the year or the end of last year. So I guess just to follow up on that, we talked about it in the past, but the preferred, right? Repurchasing preferred, if they ever dip again to, you know, 15, 16 bucks or whatever it might be, is instantly accretive, right? I mean, you can debate repurchases at NAV and so on, but buying a preferred or buying a bond at a discount is instantly accretive, and it's long lasting, right? It's a permanent elimination of a liability. Are those included on your repurchase authorization? Are you able to theoretically buy those in the next weeks or months if that opportunity came up?
Yes.
Nice, simple answer there.
Yeah.
Good.
Simple answer. I can elaborate, but you nailed it. We do look at our preferreds as debt. That coupon has to be made, you know, in under almost any circumstance. And from that point of view, it does feel a lot like debt. And really, if you look at our debt that we raise in Norway, it's essentially, it is like debt, but it's almost like a shorter term equity because there are extremely flexible covenants on it, like to the extent that we basically call them covenant free. So we do really look at them similarly. When those dip heavily, it's actually easier probably to buy those than it is to buy the bonds because the bonds have got some swaps, which can complicate things. You're 100% correct. We look at that arbitrage and say, this is something that we should try and step in. So yeah, the short answer is yes.
Thanks, Scott. Looking at your dividend, you know, I've always thought it was kind of weird. I understand why you did it in the past, but I always thought it was kind of weird that you would almost like declare your dividend for May back in like November, right? It was kind of weird to telegraph 6 months ahead like that. That being said, you've changed that policy this year. You said, hey, we're going to look at it later. We'll update you guys next time, which I suppose would be probably February, early February with the Q4 results. Is that fair? Is that correct reading of that? Is that in February we should expect to receive the updated distribution?
Yeah, you're right. Last time we did it was last year, and you'll recall we had an investor event in New York. I think it was right around this time. So we did. We probably came out earlier than we needed to, but it was one of those, when you have an investor event, you like to give some people something to so they can go back and say, I'm glad I went because this is what I learned. I think it was more of a coincidence that was done in time with where we were in November of the prior year. So I wouldn't look at it as anything more than a coincidence. We continue to talk about it with the board. We do talk every quarter about it. We will look at doing something next year. And I think that February timeline, I think we'll report Q4 at the end of February is probably about right. And you're right, it was always done way in advance because that first dividend isn't paid till May. But it was part of that trying to give that future comfort and future guidance. And this time around, we're just going to wait a little longer and then come out.
Regarding the dividend, when you come out, whether or not it's early February or whether or not you wait until the actual Q1, what have you, does that dividend payout, is that based on the underlying cash flows of the business and the underlying performance of the business, or does it relate in any way to the unit trading price when you make that decision?
Yeah, no, I don't think we look at the unit trading price. We look internally first, and the market's going to do what it's going to do. So we don't target a yield, for example. If I was, I'd be targeting 3%. I think that'd be a fantastic yield for us. But that doesn't mean I want to go out and put out a dividend that then, you know, converts to a yield of that price. We would like the unit to trade there because it's a good value and people look at that versus other securities. So no, we look internally, look at the business, look at where we can deploy capital, look at the fixed rate nature of it. And then we would look at doing that. And then I think we also look at that trajectory of year over year increases, not that we can do 30% per year like we've done the last two. But I think with the benefit of hindsight, if we can come out and say that we've raised it every year for the last 3, 4, or 5 years in a row and done it in a sustainable manner, I think you're seeing a lot of energy companies out there that are basically cutting CapEx and burning up the furniture in order to continue paying that dividend. And that's not something that we want to do. So when you look at us reporting, we say, here's how our dividend is covered by earnings, not by cash flow, not by distributable cash flow, real good hard earnings to make sure that we're on the right side of that ledger. And I think that we, admittedly, and others have been caught in that game before, and that we do not want to get back there. So sustainability is a huge part of that dividend for us.
What sort of, in terms of earnings, because I know you've shifted to an earnings coverage, and obviously that's a lot more robust than a, you know, DCF coverage. What sort of coverage ratio is comfortable? Is it like 1.5, 2 times? What should we think about in terms of earnings versus distributions?
Yeah, I don't want to go out any further than I have, because then that'll you know, maybe basically back into what we think the dividend will be, because I've already told you that our earnings are going to be fairly stable. So I think I'll wait until we have that discussion with the board in December and then come out, like we said, sometime early next year.
All right, Scott. Well, I know you're not really taking my solicitation, but, you know, 25, nice round number, easy to understand. 30, nice round number, easy to understand, easily payable. So if you want to make me happy, I know that's not your goal, but 30 cents a quarter is a beautiful number. Obviously, you know, you're one of the only
always open to feedback.
Feedback, yeah, 30 cents. That'd be, I think everybody would be very pleased
with
that.
We'll put you down.
Thank you, Scott. That's my vote. So look, I mean, you're one of the only firms to raise your distribution in 2020. I think a few firms, a good handful, were able to maintain their distributions, and, you know, an even larger number, unfortunately, cut their distribution. So that's why I bring up that unit price question. And I brought it up earlier this year because, you know, you have this, there's this nasty cycle where, you know, executives will say, we're not getting, you know, properly compensated, or this yield doesn't make sense, or, you know, we can't pay a 12% yield or 15% yield. So we're going to cut your distribution. Can you confirm, both you and Mark, still that that's not the way you think? I know you kind of sort of said that already, but you're not going to cut the distribution because of your unit price. It would have to be because of some sort of business impact.
Confirmed, Jay, and we don't see an impact coming.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely. Yeah, you made it very clear on one of your earlier calls that, you know, you get paid for your charters regardless, right? Regardless of whether the ship is picking up gas or whether it's idling or whatnot, it's basically a take or pay type contract on those ships. I think that gets lost a lot. And I think when TGP gets comped to pipeline companies, as you mentioned, pipelines have a lot of commodity exposure. TGP has none. Pipelines can't move, right? So they're slaves to that basin, whereas, of course, your ships can move. And, of course, your customers are the ones responsible for positioning those ships and exploiting those. So that's important. I know you're doing your best, but the more you can do to explain that story to institutional investors and in your presentations, I think would be helpful. On that line, in terms of helping folks understand, there's been a lot of different models out there from different analysts in terms of what your NAV is, what your forward cash flows will be. When I say forward, I don't mean 21. I think 21 is pretty obvious, but, you know, 22, 23, 24. There's been a lot of kind of uncertainty and confusion regarding the valuations of your ships and your charters, because you have almost a $10 billion backlog. So there's a lot of value that is included in that backlog and those charters. Is there anything you can do to improve, I guess, the transparency of that? Is there any plan for like a data kit or a charter book or something that you could release to analysts and investors?
I recently saw some questions about a data kit, and I'm actually not sure where that came from, Jay. I don't recall, Scott, that we were anticipating doing that.
Yeah, we've seen it from some others have done it, and a lot of it has to do with putting out some of the debt details so that people can apply that, you know, on a per vessel basis. So that is something that we are looking at. And Jay, as you know, we think that our joint ventures are still something that is difficult for people to value. And we actually put out a slide in our earnings that showed if we're valued on just the cash flow that we have that comes out on the balance sheet, I think we're at about 9.7 times. Whereas if you add in all the cash flow that accrues to us from our joint ventures, it's actually about a 7.8 times. And so that is a fairly wide arb. I think it leads you from a $11.50 stock to like a $27 stock. So illuminating and getting that full credit for the joint venture cash flows is something that we are working on, and we're always open to suggestions and trying to find a way to get people comfortable with that value. Another way that we've done it is sometimes we point to the dividends that we expect from the joint ventures of $85 to $100 million. And if I do that consolidated cash flow plus the $85 to $100 million of dividend cash flow per year, it actually gets me to about an 8x metric. So that still is a very comfortable and what we think is still a good value.
Yeah, thanks, Scott and Mark, for addressing the data kit. Yeah, I'd seen some references to that. I'm not sure. I didn't see it in your quarterly results, your conference calls, but I know there have been a few of your peers in the market, both pipeline companies and shipping companies, who have been a little bit more transparent in the last year or two on disclosing, this is, 10-year charter on this ship, and the range is, because sometimes you can't give out the exact, TCE equivalent, a time charter equivalent rate on a contract, but sometimes you can say, we expect to generate, per annum, $30 million EBITDA or what have you. And I think when folks are looking at those Yamal vessels, for example, you got a very high unlevered return on those Yamal ships, partly because, primarily because probably the political risk involved, right, of doing something like that. And I think now that project has been mostly success, right? There were some bumps in the road a year ago with the sanctions and stuff, but that's been resolved. That's been cleaned up. That project's a success. And I don't feel like you get credit for having successfully delivered all those ships and the backlog, the lucrative backlog that's attached to those. Or, for example, your Spanish LNG carriers that are on contracts ranging from 23 out to 27. And those are at rates which are massively above kind of what you would expect if you had to buy that ship today, right? And those are the kind of things that I don't think, the market gives you credit for. So I guess I'm lobbying at this point, but any sort of data kit or any sort of things you could do to be more explicit about some of those longer term sources of EBITDA would definitely be helpful.
As Scott said, thank you for the feedback, and certainly something we'll take on board. So absolutely.
Looking at kind of pivoting a little bit now, shifting towards the growth opportunities, because there's, you can delever, you can pay a distribution, you can do share repurchases, you can also focus on growth opportunities. So any updates on that? I know the last time we talked, you were mentioning how a lot of these projects were getting pushed kind of further and further back. What's kind of the soonest decision point for the next stage of growth?
Well, in terms of organic growth, at least, it has been pushed back, as you say. We were expecting to have non-commercial bids tendered by Qatar this year with priced bids within the first half of next year. I'm beginning to wonder whether the tender will be this year. I have very little doubt that it will be next year, but I can kind of foresee it sliding into the second half rather than the first half next year. And apart from Qatar, we're not hearing a lot of noise on other tenders that are coming out yet. The FIDs are still on the fence, until COVID's fully sorted. There is a tender right now by an Asian charter, large Asian charter, that is mostly being bid by the Japanese. It is a competitive tender. We've declined on it. Because it is a very looks like competitive Japanese financing might win that. And the other one out there is Arctic 2 that you can participate in on a joint venture basis, perhaps. As we've been saying for quarters and I think maybe years now, we've taken a pass on Arctic 2 because, as you say, we have some really good Yamal charters already, but probably enough given the geopolitical risk. So it's kind of it's a slow spot, to be very honest with you, right now on organic growth, Jay, on the LNG side, at least.
Thanks, Mark. Are you focusing primarily, because the two projects you mentioned are very kind of traditional LNG transport, which is your bread and butter, right? Over 90% of your business. Are you focusing basically exclusively on that, or is there any interest in some of the more fixed assets like import terminals or FSRUs or floating storage or power generation, anything like that?
We look at pretty much everything. The bread and butter is now, and I think will foreseeably always be, the point-to-point carrier to LNG. So the Qatars, the ex-intenders that are down the fairway. On the other hand, we do want to sprinkle in a fair amount of risk-adjusted, better rewarding projects. Yamal would be a great example. Another example would be the Bahrain import terminal. So we're certainly not adverse to these. It is on a case-by-case. We want decent credits and decent risk there. We have two small LNG carriers right now. They're part of the foreclosure we did on the Petrochem. So we're currently trading ethylene on those, but we use those to look at small-scale projects. The small-scale projects, they take time to get developed. So So that's the issue. We haven't been able to deploy those on an LNG basis, but thankfully they carry ethylene just as well. We look at the FSRUs. That's a pretty easy adjacency. Unlike FLNG, which is technically very complex and a fixed asset almost, FSRUs are, I think, a good business. The problem they have is, in my opinion, is they're overbuilt right now. So that's a matter of timing. I think it's going to take a while for the projects to catch up with the amount of speculative ships that were ordered, but it's certainly something that we would look at. Bunkering, LNG bunkering, we're not necessarily taking a look at. VLECs is another one. If we look at VLECs, that's the very large ethane carriers that we could easily do with our Exmar LPG JV. I think that's a great opportunity. So if we could get a decent credit on a long-term charter for very large ethane, that's as interesting to us probably as maybe LNG. But to get back to your point, no, it's right now all we're kind of seeing realistically, and we're not even seeing that much of it now, organic growth is down the fairway LNG carriage.
Yeah, thanks for running through those, Mark. Yeah, there's a lot of different stuff going on, but it's all been, it seems like, mostly put on pause during 2020. Like, we were expecting just a landslide of FSRU deals done in 2020. But then COVID happened, right? So it's just a big, and I say we, you know, from my side, I don't know what you were expecting, but, you know, that just seems like everything's been just put on pause and there hasn't been a lot of FSRU progress. So I'm hoping there'll be like kind of a landslide and a rebalancing of that market in 21. But yeah, we'll have to see. And obviously not a core business at all for you guys at this point. The Qatari orders have been just this huge overhang on the market for years. I mean, they've been talking about this order now for like 3 years. And I know you mentioned generally getting pushback. Can you remind us from your perspective, because I think you are a little bit more informed than I would be or our listeners would be on average. Can you remind us a little bit about sort of the timeline and scope of those planned orders or what they kind of look like today?
Sure. So you've seen the Qataris book a number of slots, over 60-something slots in both Korea and China. And I think the game that they'll play is that they won't necessarily book all those, but they've reserved, they won't order all those, but they've reserved all these slots. And they'll now, in the next phase, go back to the yards and say, you're going to get, you know, X amount of your reservation if your price is Y. Now, prices have been dropping a little bit. We're down to about $180 million or so on a two-stroke LNG carrier. 174 something thousand cubic meters, so which is what the Qataris seem to be looking at. And that's good for, I think, bidders. Ultimately, they're going to have residual risk at the end of the Qatari charter, and so you want to buy it as low as possible. It was expected that we would have some technical commercial stuff going on right now. That's been pushed back, and it's been an overhang, frankly. The yards are fortunately starting to get some other orders. They're getting VLCCs, they're getting container ships, so they're starting to see some other business. But they're waiting like everyone else for these Qatari orders to come through.
Yeah, we're still, I guess, we're all waiting really to see what transpires. And it really turned, you know, LNG was a very bullish sector just a year and a half, 2 years ago, and you know, the pall of that huge overhang of potential orders has really dampen the enthusiasm. And in some ways, that's good. It keeps other owners from going out there and ordering speculatively. But in other ways, it kind of scares away investors. Mark, Scott, thank you so much for joining us today. Before we close, I just want to give you one chance here. What differentiates TGP from, and you've alluded to it a little bit, but what differentiates TGP from some of these other shipping companies or some of these other energy companies? Like, you get comped a lot to pipelines. Right, and pipelines have not been a good place to invest in 2020. So what differentiates TGP and what should investors be focusing on in 21 and beyond?
Scott, do you mind if I give it a try and then you happen to you to come in?
Yeah, you go.
So I guess importantly, Jay, we, as you know, we've been reporting record quarters. Now this was a little down, but we expect fourth quarter to be good again, up again. And we expect a record year. So that's happening during COVID. That's happening, you know, this year. When others cut their guidance earlier this year, we have reaffirmed ours. And I think we're going to hit it, as we said. And that's all because we have these long-term contracts. And I think that's, and it's diverse portfolio, which is missing from the S of the LNG industry. We're 100% fixed this year. We're 96% fixed year. We have an average remaining charter period of 10 years. This is a stable business, and you could argue that maybe we've missed the upside on a half a ship or two over this winter. But overall, it's just this force of long-term contracts that we have. And the result of that, as you say, Jay, is we've been lumped in with the rest of energy, and we've traded down almost as much as others. And we're trading at a low PE despite this backlog, and we're delevering. And I'm getting a little frustrated. We have a fair amount of, not a fair amount, but a decent liquidity. And I think both Scott and I are feeling a little underloved and a little undervalued. So I heard at the start of the call that you weren't in TGP, but hopefully this has all changed your mind, and hopefully it's changed the mind of others who are listening today. Scott, I'm happy to turn it over to you.
Sure, thanks. I was just going to comment, Jay, you mentioned the whole MLP space, and it's one that we do watch. And I think that while we still are structured as an MLP, as you know, we are now a 1099 filer. There was some confusion that we were a K-1 filer, so it makes it easier for individual investors as well as for institutional investors to own us. So from that point of view, we run ourselves like a C-Corp. I think when you look at our distribution and our dividend, both the level that we're paying as well as the capacity, we're running ourselves a little bit more like a C-Corp than some of these pipelines that are actually paying out way more than they actually earn. So that is not our case. And we also don't have to grow in order to meet our dividend. You know, the old model of raise your distribution, go out, put CapEx to work, raise it again. And you almost had to be on this treadmill in order to meet your dividend was to continue growing. We don't have to do that. We can sit in this position for years and maintain this dividend. And then that leads me to my last point is we don't have any unfunded CapEx. A lot of the question marks that come out of the MLP space is, well, if you do have to keep growing, how are you going to be able to do this when your equity price is so low and so therefore the cost of your equity is so high? We don't have any unfunded CapEx. We have a very low burn. It's about $30 million per year is what we put into dry docks. I use the analogy. It's like a building. It costs a lot to build it. But once it's up, it's pretty cheap to maintain, and ships very much the same way. So we don't have any unfunded CapEx. We don't need to use our equity price in order to grow and in order to sustain our dividend. So I think that's a difference as well from us versus the MLP space abroad.
Yeah, thanks for breaking that down, Mark, and then Scott as well. I think, TGP is very interestingly positioned. I think, you asked about, my personal position. You know, it's a matter of, you look around the shipping space and you see, stuff down 75% or 60% versus, you've actually outperformed basically everything in shipping this year. So, if you were positioned in TGP versus peers, we won't name names on peers, but TGP versus some historical peers, you would have done a lot better with your stock. So of course that might change going forward. One of the things I would like to see, look, I guess I'll end it on a lobbying note and, write it down or ignore it as you will, but continuing to raise that distribution and sending that strong signal to your investor base, I think would do wonders. I think, raising, I like 30 cents. It's a nice round number. It's easily payable, easily covered. I like that number. It's a nice one. I know it might not be there. In terms of repurchases, yeah, you trade at you mentioned in the earnings call, 5x earnings, 8x cash flow. Repurchases at this point are far more accretive than deleveraging. I know you need to delever. We understand that, but some sort of balance would be appropriate. So those are my kind of Christmas wish list, a month and a half early. But as always, it's always great to host you guys on here and get your updates on the market. Thanks, Mark, and thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Jay.
Thank you very much.
This concludes another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live. We are recording about 11:45 Eastern Time on 13 November. We hosted TK LNG Partners, CEO Mark Creeman and CFO Scott Gayton to discuss the LNG markets as well as TGP's positioning. As a reminder, nothing on this call constitutes official company guidance or investment recommendations in any form.
If you've been enjoying the Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, you can subscribe through iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Stitcher. You can also give reviews on those platforms to help other investors discover this podcast. Jay Mintzmyer runs the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's M-I-N-T-Z-M-Y-E-R, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Value Investor's Edge there.